Welcome or welcome back to the Trending Communicator. I'm your host, Dan Nessel. You know, I keep saying that the communications profession is dealing with unprecedented change. I mean, that's why I launched Trending Communicator. If we can get a hold of the trends and the changes happening inside and outside of the marketing and communications professions, then we'll be better at our jobs and better advisors, better communicators. Today, let's take a broad look at some of what's happening in the world of integrated marketing communications with someone who, by any standard of measure, is a leader and contributor to the profession as a whole. Over three decades, she's blazed a career path that so many PR pros dream of, working her way up the agency ladder from her start as an associate at Burson Marsteller to building, leading, and growing an award-winning agency, to shepherding that agency through an acquisition, and ultimately becoming a partner and CEO of the new combined agency. Along the way, she chalked up honor after honor, including the PR Week 40 Under 40, multiple appearances in the PR Week Global Power Book, PR News Top Women in PR, can go on and on. She's a committed advocate for diversity and inclusion, ethics in our profession, so much more. Please welcome the CEO of G&S Business Communications and my friend, Anne Green. Anne, it is good to see you.
Hey, Dan. So glad to be here. This is so kind. I'm laughing about how long ago the 40 Under 40 Award was, but it's nice to hear about it sometimes.
Well, we don't have to specify dates on this show. I mean, That's right. I are of the same sort of generation. And, you know, that's sort of under the banner of no one really needs to know, but they'll figure it out. So,
exactly.
You know, things we talk about. So forgive the references sometimes as we jam here. You've had a great career and I am, you know, I know that a lot of our listeners are in our world and, you know, they're in agencies or they're on the client side. I think, you know, before we get into all the stuff, and by stuff, I mean, you know, the changes happening in the profession, and by changes happening in the profession, I kind of think we're going to be talking a lot about AI, but there's a lot of other things too. But before we get into that, I'd love for our listeners to know a little more about you. And, you know, if you can just, you know, give a little overview of, you know, how you got to where you are, because that career path that you've had is almost textbook of what's a success in PR, especially on the agency side, look like. So how did you do it? And what were the highlights? And, you know, what can you tell us?
Yeah, it seems like really rational and logical. And what's funny is it's really quite accidental in some ways. My undergraduate work was highly liberal arts focused. I was lucky enough to, and I consider it a privilege to be able to do an internship. You know, that's not something I take for granted. It's something that I think all of us really advocate for, trying to give more support for those who, that may be harder. But, you know, I intended to be a literature professor. And in fact, during my time at Burson Marsteller, right after it, and while I was helping to build Cooper Katz, which is the agency that you referred to in the middle of the journey before GNS, I actually went to NYU and did most of my PhD in American literature in the highly relevant area of 19th century American literature with a focus on Edgar Allan Poe. So that's a whole lot.
Oh,
there.
Goodness.
But I love teaching. But I wanted to not go straight to grad school. And so I was looking for internships and I found the Harold Burson Summer Internship Program, which was Burson's flagship internship. It was competitive. It was 10 people every summer in New York and some of the other offices. And I, you know, didn't really have access to internet back in those days in the late 80s, early 90s, but I was able to intuit what PR was and, you know, make it through writing phases and then interviewing and got that internship. And ended up going there after graduation from Vassar College. And I think what was great is I was like, let me take some time, let me work, let me just explore the world before I go to grad school. So I spent a few years at Burson and I was lucky enough to be there at a time where there were some very senior people that Harold Burson was still alive. I used to ride the elevator with him, which was inspiring. Bill Marsteller had passed, but I was there with a lot of people that had helped build the firm from the 70s. And some of them were starting to move on to start their own agencies. But I got to start in B2B and consumer marketing. So I was working with like world-class brands, both on B2B and B2C. And it was a great training ground. I mean, I learned so much and I was in factories and I was in like, I was just learning how things were made and learning the craft. And Burson, of course, was the largest agency of the world at that time. So we had a newsroom. I could see the AP wire. We had a creative team. They would help us make the slides, you know, and we had early access to the web. And we, you know, and I met Ralph Katz and Andy Cooper, who were very senior, and they formed Cooper Katz. And so even as I went off to grad school, I said to myself, well, I'll go help Andy and Ralph. I'll freelance for a while I'm doing my coursework. And then, of course, that was 96. And 22 years later, I had left a dissertation stage. Like, I'd said goodbye to academia, which was fine. You know, I made that decision open-hearted. I loved it, but there were reasons to leave because I loved our field too. And I ended up CEO and a partner in the firm. And, you know, and we were, you know, $6 million agency by that time and 30 people. So it is an interesting thing because once I got into the career, it seems very linear, but I really am an accidental CEO too. I don't have an MBA. I never intended, but I love organizational leadership. So I think the loving the subject matter, the curiosity about so many different subjects you learn in this field. And I know your career has been really diverse, Dan, right?
Many
subjects. And then the love of leading people and leading organizations, and it's not for the faint of heart, but it's so rewarding. So yeah, that's my arc, which is fun to reflect on at this point.
You make me want to go down memory lane just a little bit there. Because Cooper Katz, that's our connection originally.
I know.
Was through Cooper Katz. And, you know, I had the privilege and honor, I suppose, to meet Andy before he passed. And this was 15 years ago or so. I was working at the AICPA at the time, and we held a pitch and hired Cooper Katz as a result of that to help us with some of the things we were doing. Killer team, so much attention. But the main thing I remember from those days was how attentive and kind Andy and Ralph were. And you know, it's the kind of thing where you understand the value of that client, or it's rather, I even hate to say client, but the partnership that you have with your clients and with the agency. And it taught me a lot about what a good agency relationship should look like, you know? And then thankfully, as time went on, I stayed in touch with Ralph and this is a reminder for me. I got to reach out to Ralph again, because we used to catch up for lunch every couple of years.
He's doing great.
And believe me, we're going to send him this show when it's done. But what a mensch, as I would say. But he is just such a genuinely a genuine leader in the PR world and in client relationships, and to have learned and been at his side and Andy's side too, I suppose, must have been just, I don't know, I was listening to somebody calling it the rub, right? Not like as in that's the rub, but as in it rubbed off on you in some noticeable way.
I'm reflecting on as you talk, and it's such a great memory. I mean, this is why we're having a session coming up soon with our own team about networking, especially with our younger team members. And it kind of reminds you, this is about relationships over time and just staying in touch with people that you enjoy and you care about and you want to, and as you get older and farther in your career, you can do more to be, you know, collaborative. But what you're making me think of is this industry can be very intense, right? Especially on the agency side, but also the client side too, the corporate side, right? It's it's high performance. It's very demanding. On the agency side, it's very competitive. It's competitive for talent. It's competitive for clients, right? However, I will say that when I think about how I came up, and that's Burson, and especially with Andy Cooper and Ralph Katz, and we did lose Andy in 2013 to cancer, and he's an amazing person. Ralph is doing great. But they were indicative of a lot of generosity of leadership, and it's generosity of spirit that I encounter in this agency. And you and I both being part of Page, that community, the PR council where I've been a board member, you know, here you're in the room with other agency CEOs of all sizes. And when we joined the PR Council in 98, Cooper Katz was quite small. I'm now representing, you know, a much larger agency and with Page as well. But I have to say, I continue to find that spirit of generosity everywhere, even amidst the competitiveness. And that shaped me, to your point. It rubbed off on me that I think with Andy and Ralph specifically, ethics, really doing the right thing, having an ethical lens on how you view your work and holding that line for yourselves and for your client to protect both and to bring out the better angels on all sides. And then also kindness. And then also a really high bar for doing good work. You know, some of my mentors, like Andy, you could tell if he was like, this is mediocre and it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
And I try to be kind about that, but I want to hold a high bar too. And it's a very interesting time to do that as we grapple with the sort of new technology, as you said. And I think we'll be arrested if we don't talk about AI. I think actually
of course,
we'll police will come in and shut the podcast down. But,
but
that's the kind of stuff you make me think of in terms of those human relationships. It's really quite a generous industry.
Well, maybe, you know, that brings in mind a probably a good place to start the discussion about change in the industry, because the things that you're talking about, I think, are timeless and evergreen, that, you know, you have to have that ethical approach, kindness, eye for quality, or understanding what quality really is, what's good work. And we always say, you know, don't let perfect be the enemy of good, et cetera. But that's a really hard thing for PR people to grapple with, I've found, especially when so many of us either were trained as writers or just had that writing skill that got us through everything. And I never went into the world. I never, you know, was trained in any particular way apart from academic times, college, et cetera. But I always had a thing for writing and I always was good at it, especially editing. And I have found that that's one of the unchangeable and unchanging aspects of our profession. No matter how much we find the help in AI, in our little interns and assistants and partners that I call AI, other people might call them other things. But no matter how good your large language models get at editing things, they're never going to get as good as the people who understand what people want to see and read and who get those nuances of language that kind of defy usage and defy grammar and defy convention. So there's always a role for that, but it's critically important, I think, for us to continue to be great writers and great editors. And I think you even alluded in some way to the idea that everybody needs to be a critical thinker too. I mean, you have to really examine everything that you do and never take yes for an answer, or never take no for an answer, just question and be curious. And those things are I think, threads that just going to continue to run through the profession. It's everything else around it that I think is wildly unhinged and fraying and tying up in different directions. But, you know, it is a wild profession. And it's challenging.
You know, I'd love to reflect on some of what you're saying. You're reminding me of a few things. I remember, being in their careers when we have been, and I'm a proud Gen Xer.
Me too.
But we got to see a lot of change happening in a compressed time. And of course, we got to see one of the biggest shifts, which is writing to the web, you know, TypePad, WordPress, the advent of blogging, the advent of social media, advent of two-way communication, which really changed the nature of comms. That command and control was kind of lost in many ways, which is a good thing. It's a wild world. But the thing about writing that throughout that period, I remember hearing over and over again, there's always that fear of, like, say when Twitter launched, or X, if you will, this feeling, oh, it's 140 characters. My God, it's going to destroy writing. Or that social media now is just bits and bytes. So there's no substantive writing anymore. There was also a big discussion. You might remember the Atlantic article, which was titled, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" Mm-hmm. You know, because our brain skill sets are different now than, say, I mentioned before, literature from the 19th century. Someone like Edgar Allan Poe had an encyclopedic memory of what he read, spoke multiple languages, and would spend without electric light, you know, nights with a candle writing, just voluminous, volumes and volumes of writing, and had to store a lot of that, you know. Our brains work differently. They're very plastic. So I think I agree with the through line point. No matter how often we've decried, oh, we're going to lose this ability, that ability, or writing is not going to matter anymore, writing continues to matter. So what happened was content continued to be critical. and more modes, more channels, and more types of writing, short form, long form, feature, editorial, on and on and on, and then video. And I think too about, you know, the modes. Our brains are plastic and will adapt to different modes and channels of information gathering. So maybe we don't need to retain as much, but we'll access it in different ways. I think, though, the other through line is that there's always been, side by side with a need for writing and critical thinking, always a worry that people could work harder at their writing. And I do think now, and we can talk about it now or put a pin in it for later, that I think we'd all agree the internet is flooded with a lot of garbage.
Oh yeah.
I hope our industry tries to minimize our role in that, but I know that marketing comms plays a role in pumping stuff out, right? Whether it's paid, earned, whatever. But there, I do think back to your point that human intervention of writing that is precise or that sparkles or that has energy or that's alive or that leaps off the page. You know, I try to say to my peers, and especially younger ones, I want to see writing that's electric. I'd like to see it be alive, even if it's a marketing pitch or something, or a deck for new business or whatever. So I think that, and then the critical thinking to say, what is something that's really actually interesting right now? What is thought leadership versus just a title that is not really thought leadership at all? So you're making me think about a lot of things at one time.
Well, it's good because we have to think about a lot of things at one time. That's the nature of our profession, actually. And I think,
sure,
I think a lot of our listeners don't always understand that. They don't understand. A lot of people won't understand PR apart from, oh, those are the people that spin things, or those are the people that you know, represent famous people as a publicist, or you know, those are just tiny corners of what we do. And you know, the idea of equating it, just if I could, you know, step back a little bit, the idea of equating doing a good job with spin absolutely just infuriates me.
Yeah.
You know, there's a new AI tool out called Suno. I don't know if you've seen it yet. Suno AI. It is,
no, I haven't.
It's hysterical. I mean, it's in the gimmicky stage, I think, right now. But with a prompt, it makes a song.
Oh,
with a simple prompt, it just creates a song. And the song are ridiculously good. Like, you know, it takes just a few seconds and you have, you know, for in the free version, a minute and a half of a song in any style that you put in there, and with lyrics and vocals and everything. So as a kind of, I don't know, either a joke or a moment of utter internal clarity, I was experimenting with it the other day, and I prompted it with, you know, write a blues song about a PR and communications professional executive who's tired of waking up every day and having to spin the truth and just wants to be a straight talker for a change. And it came up with this song called Shadows of Deception.
Oh my God.
it is great. I will share it with you later, Anne, remind me. But I was astounded because that's the prompt that I gave it. And it came up with, you know, three verses of lyrics that, you know, on a bad day, that's my life sometimes. Like I'm not saying that I have to spin for Lixell at all, but I am, you know, we're all kind of pressured sometimes to just make things sound like they don't supposed to sound, or, you know, take the stink off the, you know, off the rose, or whatever metaphor you want to choose. It's infuriating. So, you know, I think our profession, and certainly the kind of things that the kind of role that we have to play for more and more is that of arbiter of what's good and what's not. And, you know, apply that critical thinking to say, look, let's ditch the spin and let's, you know, apply the principles of quality and good writing and truth, I suppose, to what we're doing. And, you know, I think where I was going with this was that technology and all the crap that's out there that you mentioned, you didn't say those words, but...
Oh, I might have. I think I didn't.
It is what it is, right? It's garbage. Yeah. It's crap. There's terrible content out there.
The internet is just loaded with a lot of content that's just...
And it doesn't get better.
Now.
Certainly doesn't get better. You know, we are uniquely qualified to both be the guard against that but also to be corrupted into making that kind of crap. You know what I mean? Like there are people who will just take the cash and just make that nonsense. And that's a problem for marketers and communicators out there who want to do good work.
I think you're making an interesting point. One thing you remind me of is years ago, and I could never remember what the source was, but I remember seeing some research that showed that there was probably a higher degree of ethical awareness in this field than in many others, because we're on the front lines, especially on the agency side, but on the corporate side too, of representing things to other stakeholders. Mm-hmm. On the agency side, we have contracts that have, you know, dual indemnification, because which is really legally important, because we're representing information on behalf of a company like yours, and they're giving us information, and we're both kind of liable for that. So I think that there's a lot of misperceptions about what this industry is about. But like anything in human life, there are the two sides of it. You know, there's the angels and the bad actors. And I think that the vast majority of our crew in this field, and I've met thousands of people now, as you have, just so many amazing people of all ages. Yeah. There is really a high standard and a lot of deep thought about what is happening with the media. What is the role of a media in a democracy, a big, messy media landscape? What is the role of paid channels versus owned channels? What kind of content are we putting out there? What is hitting our stakeholders? And I do very, very much agree with you, and you and I have talked about this offline before this podcast, that I don't know if our industry reflects enough on how well-suited we are to grapple very intentionally and optimistically, but also thoughtfully and with a lot of control over these new technology tools.
For sure.
And that part of that is really bringing an ethical lens to it, to ask ourselves, like, how are they being used? And to be super, super self-educating and educating individually and as an industry on how are they changing and what is happening, what's the structure behind it and all that good stuff. And also drawing a line for ourselves and for others that we're working with, you know?
Yeah. And the way that we comport ourselves and the work that we produce is our way to show that we can do these things.
Yes.
And we just only hope that either we have the persuasive capabilities, the influence capabilities, probably more influence than persuasion, I would think, but we have those capabilities to build those relationships with our stakeholders and in mm-hmm. both internally and if you're an agency with your clients, you know, that would garner the trust that you need for them to start to respect your capability to contribute in that way, which is a very long slog. And in many cases, it's a long haul. And, you know, that's one of the things about our profession that I think other functions don't necessarily need to contend with to that degree. You know, if you're excellent at finance, you're excellent at finance, it's pretty clear, you know? But if you're a CFO and you need to create insights for your business out of finance, that's a different story, right? It's not just about how good you are with numbers and tax code and all those other things. Then it becomes more about, wow, what interesting strategic directions have you suggested for the company? And I think that's the same thing with us, you know, in many ways. Mm-hmm. Anybody coming out of college can, you know, theoretically edit or write a document or learn how to do a press release, the basics, right? Summarize the media, which is another thing we're going to need to talk about, because who knows if that's going to be necessary as much anymore. But you know, to rise up as you have through all the levels of mm-hmm. client service, of internal management structure, you know, takes a much broader and I think more, you know, I think a more widely applicable skill set in many ways. And that's part of the change, I think, facing our profession. Like it used to be, I think, that communications or PR and GR and AR, like all these R's were that kind of pigeonholed into certain things that you do. Mm-hmm. Now those guardrails, the silos, the cages, whatever you want to call them, are permeable or breaking down. And some people are not taking advantage of it, but I think a lot of us really see that. And, you know, that is one of the things that's powering the change in the profession, is that we, as professionals, want to do more to help our businesses because we think we can. We want to help ourselves, our careers. We want to expand our capabilities. We want to learn because, you know, so many of us are just habitual learners and very, very curious people.
Yes.
So all those things together, you know, are powering the engine of change. And we as Gen Xers, you know, we've been through a couple of iterations already, and maybe that also uniquely qualifies us to deal with the next one or this current one, which may be the biggest one ever. And that, of course, is artificial intelligence, Gen AI, especially with respect to, you know, to comms and to marketing. So, you know, as we look at Gen AI and what it means, I mean, what a broad question.
Yeah.
You know, let's just start with some high level thoughts there. I mean, you know, you talked about different modes and channels of accessing information. Talked about, we both talked about writing capabilities and mm-hmm. critical thinking. You know, so from the get-go, Gen AI is changing the way we approach these things and do these things. What are you seeing as, you know, from the agency side and as somebody who has broad view of so many businesses and types of businesses and clients and yeah. partners within the industry? You know, what are like the top things that you would kind of want to pick on?
Yeah, there's so much there. It's so true. And it's an adoption curve for sure, but it's a moving target. So we've been here before. It's also an arms race on the tech side. So many new platforms. I'm not even talking about like the big gorillas and, you know, yeah. which new iteration of Claude or GPT, ChatGPT, et cetera, and what other big ones, or Gemini, you know, now as yeah. evolved from the Google platform. I'm talking about, you know, what's being created on smaller levels and also what's drafting off of those big guys. Like you said, there's like a million new things every day, right? So there's a whole lot of ways we're racing at one time. This is true in corporations and on the agency side. I think the agency side is particularly acute because we feel that responsibility to stay ahead of the curve and to really be those counselors, right? And you don't, there's certain things they say, fake it until you can make it. That's just not acceptable or real in this kind of situation. So I think that there's a lot of normal stuff we're sorting through, which we saw before in the social media era and the Web3 era, which is like, what tools and platforms do you need? What's their cost structure? It's changing every day. There's 7 million of them. And who's testing what? Who's building what? But from my perspective, I'm really looking at it at three levels organizationally for us and then, you know, for the partners we have and really the whole industry, because I'm having these conversations all over the place. It's the ground level, meaning what is the tools? How is it proliferating AI capabilities and tools we're already using? Because the enterprise landscape of software and SaaS, that's where it is ground zero for a lot of us on a business level and also a personal level too. How is it being baked into our, you know, consumer tools? And then what new platforms do we need to test? And then what training do folks need? You know, and I like training all the way from, you know, obviously prompt engineering, but also how is it evolving, but then use cases, but then also like, how do we think about the ethics side of it and IP and bias and et cetera? The yep. mid-level to me becomes, that's the ground level. The mid-level is about intentional engagement and execution and pilots. What are the kinds of pilot programs we're running internally? What are the kinds of tests we're going to run very intentionally with clients to see where is the value? Meaning, maybe you want more efficiency. Maybe you want to automate or eliminate rote tasks. You know, none of us are pasting clips into a book, like those of you in PR would know that from years ago. We're not doing that stuff anymore. We don't need to do that stuff anymore. So, or where are there higher value things around personas and content generation that isn't garbage, that's actually useful? And then the top level for me is where I really want, I invite everybody, it doesn't matter whether an intern here or my partners in ownership, or you're a CEO or someone in school, I want to invite people to think about big picture questions like, what will it mean to be human? What does authorship mean? What does it mean to have co-intelligence or augmented intellect? What does it mean to treat an AI like a companion in that way? I think AIs are going to be companions in many ways. You know, this is mm-hmm. a wild world and it'll be very human and very alien at the same time. So I feel it's incumbent upon us all to think ground level, mid-level, and high level. And that can also be conceived as immediate, short, near-term, and far-term, because none yeah. of us have a crystal ball. But one thing I will say is that I've been around for a lot of prognostication where it's like agencies are dead, the press release is dead, this is dead, that is dead. And usually, and it's also not true that nothing's going to change. And yep. I think we've got to be in that moment now too, to say like, I'm going to resist the extremes, but also be very open to some very radical change.
I think the tendency of humans is to just immediately assume it's a zero-sum game.
Yes.
Things that are the way they are now are going to be the way they always are.
I hate zero-sum thinking, and boy, we do it all the time.
We do it all the time, and it's the source of so much, so much strife.
Yes.
Because, you know, by that philosophy or by that measure, if I have something, then you don't have it.
Yes.
And it's very dangerous. You know,
and by the way, I can't co-sign on that enough. And it's dangerous everywhere. It's dangerous between two people. It's dangerous in organizations. It's dangerous in a society.
100%.
And it's something we have to resist.
Yeah. And I go on sometimes about abundance thinking and all that kind of stuff. People talk about fixed mindset versus learning mindset. It's all one and part of the same, pie, I suppose. But to get out of our own way and to stop navel gazing and sort of say, okay, yeah, we're going to change. But, you know, the profession as we know it is probably going to be a different profession several years from now, but it's still our profession. And yes, everything I read and all the wonderful people I speak to and, you know, being immersed in AI, especially as I am, there's no question change is could happen very, very fast. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's going to happen that fast where everybody is suddenly going to be out on the street. I mean, that's not the way it is. You know, Gary Vee, who I, by the way, don't enjoy very much. occasionally he says things that are actually good or true.
He is a personality.
He is a personality. Yeah, I'm not a follower. But, you know, he says that, you know, if you're not using AI at least 20 or 30 or whatever an hour a day, then you are going to be dead in the water. I wouldn't go that far, but I do think that in our profession, if you are not getting familiar with AI, with generative AI especially, and if you're not experimenting and asking, what if I do this? What if all the time, then you will be left behind or you'll be relegated to kind of just trying to figure out how to edit the next press release or whatever it is, right? So there is going to be a difference between those who, I don't even want to say embrace, but those who adopt and see the way to use AI for themselves and for their organization and so on, and those who don't. But back to your three levels, the ground level, intentional engagement, and I'll call it philosophical level, those three things. Mm-hmm. It seems like, you know, it's not just midterm, short, mid, long-term, although it's helpful to think of it that way. But I think that people are in all three of these places at once in many cases. And it really depends on, you know, what you're trying to accomplish with that particular AI or that task. In our case, or in my personal case, I'm probably all three. Like, you know, I have discussions all the time about this. What does it mean to be human?
Oh, yes.
And it's such a critical part of this. And we should get back to that shortly. But I spend most of my time in the ground level, right? Most of the time is like training people or understanding the tools, you know, and just understanding the enterprise landscape and trying to, within my company anyway, spread the word, educate, advocate for the suite of tools that our IT team has created, which is really, I will say, such an advancement over so many other companies. Like, some companies are doing nothing, and you know, we have a killer team in Japan that's been, you know, doing whatever they can to provide access to, you know, to this game changing. I keep saying technology, but this game-changing entity thing, whatever, of AI that, you know, because I think they recognize that, you know, the AI-enabled business is the one that is going to win, or it's the minimum, it's going to be table stakes for being able to compete, you know? So I find myself at that ground level a lot, and just playing around. But it's hard to get the word out.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things I've been thinking about as you were talking. I used to joke that no one had an existential crisis over a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet because it's a business tool and it's real cut and dry. Mm-hmm. Social media really collapsed the private and public domain, the personal and business domain. It really was a collapse of that divide. And it tracked with a lot of other trends in society, in technology, in business, in life that changed the nature of that intermingling that we use mm-hmm. the word hybrid today in different ways. But
right.
And I think that this tool, social media, was challenging in that way. It continues to be challenging. Generationally, people may be used to it, but they still have a lot of feelings about it. And it's complicated, especially as they've seen the impact of algorithms over time, the kind of unintended consequence that we sort of wandered into. Jaron Lanier and others were talking about it for a long time. But I think now that this is even more complicated in terms of how people feel about it and relate to it, there's going to be a very diverse adoption curve. Like anything, people have to find their killer app. The first time I heard that phrase, which was more in the dot-com boom, it reminded me of the first time I saw spell check on the early personal computers in the 80s. And I realized mm-hmm. for the first time why I might want to learn to use a computer. Before that time, I was like, I don't know if I need this.
Yeah.
I saw spell check and I'm like, damn, I need this. And the idea of the killer app, finding those killer apps, those moments that is your personal entree. So it's like, there's the business tool. Okay. I could learn to use it and rationally understand it. And how might AI augment me and, you know, and make things efficient. And this is how this works. And I'm playing with this. But where is that moment where you cross the Rubicon into a personal relationship with like, this technology is truly useful to me and wow, it's lighting me up. Right. And so, you know, you and I both listened to the Ezra Klein podcast. He's doing some incredible deep dives into this and speaking with people like Ethan Mollick. And, you know, Ethan was saying that you really need to spend 10 hours with it. And part of it is not just like treating it like I will put in question, you give answer.
Right.
It's more that discursive process of building and learning and also training these tools to manifest in a personality or a set of parameters that you can relate to or that relate to the business need or the personal need. This is a radically different shift. And I think for me, as I contemplate this and like you try to get as deep as I can and also try to push myself to be hands-on where I am also finding barriers to be like, how am I using this today? I'm not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that I'm trying to also, something you said earlier, project myself forward and say, what is this future state going to look like? I'm standing in this agency, in this physical space. What does it look like? What are we doing? What are we not doing? What was hard? What was easy? I think project back to the adoption curve for Web 1, Web 2, and social. And I can see what those shifts ended up being. I can see how hiring changed. We don't look that different, but we are profoundly different. So I am very interested in this question and I want to keep interrogating because I'm not 100% sure. Like I was just having a discussion with a few agency CEOs yesterday, like, will our hiring change? Will the entry level look different? Like these are big questions of how do we project forward where the pace of change is so massive that it's hard and we don't really have an analog for it, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. At least when it comes to things like Web 1 and Web 2 and social, you know, it's a flat screen. It's a one way, it's going from one way communication to two way communication. Yeah. Oh, wow. People can comment and oh, isn't this great? And, oh my God, isn't this terrible? Like it's this whole cycle.
Was it.
We've been in it. We've been dealing with it. Most people are still in Web 2 and just dealing with that. And
absolutely.
We're seeing the consequences in so many ways. And, you know, it took on a life of its own and in many ways gave technology as a whole a very bad rap and a high level of suspicion. No, rightly so. Brands, people should be suspicious and should approach with extreme caution anything new that they're doing. And by extreme caution, I mean, protect your personal information. I mean, you know, like do the steps that you need to do now in this world of ours. You know, it's, you know, imagine that every time you log in to any tool, it's like going through airport security, right? You gotta take your shoes, you know, unless you have that. Maybe you have your facial recognition, which is your TSA pre, and you don't have to take your shoes off. But generally speaking, you gotta go through this process. And then you got to change it up all the time because, you know, bad people get smarter too. And that's just the way it is. Now add AI to this, and it's a whole new level of stuff. People aren't sure whether to treat it as a layer of technology that requires the same type of thinking or something completely different. Now, of course, you and I both think it's something, it's both of those things, but it's also something very, very, very different. We also don't know. It's a black box, right? We keep hearing that. It's black box, black box. Yeah. Ethan Mollick, you mentioned before, is doing incredible work in trying to figure out what the heck is in that black box.
I love it. I know it's so interesting.
Fascinating. And 10 hours is nothing on this. You can,
exactly.
You know, it just goes by. But getting back to something that you said and you know, how I think we need to approach it even at the beginning is you said something and I'm laughing because I include it when I talk about AI with people who don't understand AI or when I train people in my organization. You know, one of the first things I say is you have to learn a new way of speaking that isn't any new way of speaking at all, right? So you have to learn, you have to get past this cognitive dissonance that everything is Google. Like you ask a question, you get an answer. Oh, thank you. Bye. You're done.
Mm-hmm. Like the transactional nature.
Transactional. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. In the case of generative AI, as you know, and you know, many of the large language models that are out there, you need to approach it as if you are about to have an interaction. Call it a conversation, call it an interrogation, whatever it is, you know that you will get more out of it when you're able to refine the things that you are saying and you're thinking even along the way.
Yes.
You know, when you go to Google with a question, you have the question. I have a question. Here's my answer. When you go to, you know, ChatGPT or Claude or, you know, and I love Claude these days, by the way, but when you go to ChatGPT or Claude, you know, you may have a question, but understanding that, you know, you're essentially walking up to something that has access to all of the information that has ever been digitized and, you know, give or take. And if I was going to ask you, Anne, you know, tell me about an agency. Now you have your agency experience. You could talk about what agencies are from your experience at Burson and then at KuberCats and now at GNS for communications and for business communications, right? But you'll tell me about an agency and I'll say, okay, great. But really, what I really want to know is what about an advertising agency or marketing agency?
Yeah.
Or maybe what I really want to know is something completely different. So if it was Google, I would, you know, ask a question, come back. But with AI, I would approach and then I'd be, oh, no, that's not what I mean. Let me refine my question. Let me talk to you a little bit more. And we'd have a conversation until I kind of got to the bottom line of what your knowledge is. Now with AI and what kind of questions I should be asking you, right? With AI, you know, you can have a lot of thinking beforehand and sort of, you know, understand your context and instruct this thing that has billions and billions and billions of bytes of data, whatever, I don't know what the amount, terabytes, you know, gigabyte, I don't know, but all of this data. And, you know, you have to realize that you're asking it a simple question when it has all of the complexity in the world to search through to get to that simple question. So you need to give it a little bit of a guideline. Right? So that it's not wasting its time and go back and forth and iterate.
It reminds me, it is a new old language because it's more human language, but that's too simplistic and also complicated at the same time. But
yeah,
it reminds me of the early days of search. We had to be trained and Google helped to refine this training of how to do search. Now you went from Ask Jeeves for, our older folks out there remember Ask Jeeves, right?
I remember Jeeves.
Where people would write very long questions because that's, you came to it like human that hadn't been trained in search yet. Then we got trained to get really small and precise about like just a phrase and we got really good at it. People are very good at search today, right? Very, very good.
Yeah.
And then we realized, oh, Google's super smart. And it's reading for meaning. You know, this is the early days of AI. It's able to understand. So our queries got longer. And we all know the stats that most searches like are pretty unique. They're quite distinct from each other. I forget the exact stats. But to go into it more in a conversational mode, a real back and forth, like you're doing an interview, an interrogation. It reminds me of media training. This is not interrogation. But to go through it with full, complete sentences and also paragraphs and say, as you said, Claude, that wasn't my intention. I want you to rethink about this in a new context. What if I was asking about this area of inquiry? And also, don't forget, I want you to add this layer to it and this context to it. We're not trained to interact that way with machines. We've been trained to interact with humans that way. So
right.
To me, it goes back to that plasticity of the brain, how quickly we adapt.
That's right.
We have to confront change and how resilient and quick we are when we find those killer apps, especially suddenly everybody's behavior changes. I mean, the second that Google Maps launched with traffic, everyone's like, now I need a cell phone. You know, I need an That's iPhone right. for this. So, but it's what you're saying is very key to how we are changing now and are going to have to change. And how hard is that learning curve?
Yeah. It's a learning curve. It's a mindset. And it's like we said, it's again, this kind of cognitive dissonance where I'm looking at a computer, so I have to behave a certain way.
Yeah.
But you're telling me that all I need to do is like use my normal natural language and something's going to happen. What's that about? With people who are getting the most out of Gen AI, especially, it's, you know, they're getting the most out of it because they think about all the different things that they want to say or that they want, like all the different permutations or directions that this could possibly go. And they're like, no, I don't want it to go in that direction. I don't want to go in that. I have it. Like I have an idea and I want to see if it's going to work. I'm going to give all the information I possibly can. And then I'm going to remember, oh yeah, I think it would be useful if, you know, if the AI had this other information to look at, and oh, maybe it would be useful if it had this data to look at, you know, and then you can start to add more and more in, and people have to understand this multimodal thing where you can use different types of media and you can talk about different kinds of things, and such a leap, it's such a jump from where we are, and sometimes it's easy to overlook that or easy to forget that for those of us who've been in it, you know, deeply because we love this kind of stuff, or we know it's necessary, you know, that the vast majority of people still are in the question and answer goodbye mode. And this is, I think, the very first thing that needs to really happen in order for folks to find that killer app. You know, AI, the other great thing about AI is, or dangerous thing, I don't know, depends how you look at it, is the killer app is you and your thinking. So at the most basic level, you hear about things, people creating prompts just on their own, a great prompt that they then cut and paste and put someplace else and hold on to because they're going to use it again and again and again in order to, you know, create something that they need to create again and again and again. And guess what you've just done? You've just coded a program is what you've done. Mm-hmm. You've coded. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. But you've just been able to do it with your natural language. So it's this making these connections to what you're actually able to do. You've created an app. Every prompt you make is an app, essentially, you know, if you can use it repeatedly. So the way that your mind has to kind of expand, I'd say, or just drop conventional approaches and conventional wisdom. It's more like that, again, going back to Carol Dweck, the learning mindset, you know, you have to be flexible when you kind of approach these things. And
that's
true. Yeah, we've gone. Yeah.
Oh, no, I think that part of it is, then it brings me back to, you know, what is, you know, as an organizational leader and as a communicator that has been working for this long and as a counselor, I'm still actively counseling clients and still actively training. You know, I love media training and presentation skills training. And, you know, I'm still actively doing my craft as well as leading. You know, part of it is inviting folks to really think differently so that they can understand how to engage in new ways. And that's whoever I run into or you run into, and also myself. And then pushing myself to get uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable moment. This kind of changes, like really uncomfortable, especially when you're hearing the prognosticators. And bless Gary Vee for telling us all we're going to just be right off the ship. You know, if I get it, right? We've heard that kind of stuff for years. And that's the kind of stuff that I don't have a lot of patience for, but I get why. We need the kick in the butt. I get it.
For sure.
And I take it for what it's worth. You know, I use it for fuel. But to me, that's where also bringing it back down to that ground level, mm-hmm. which is what makes it real, what makes it useful, what brings us to value. Another one of the things I've been saying later is work smarter, not harder. How do we do that? And how do we make sure that, especially if time on the agency side, that time we're being paid for, how do we make sure that time is being used in the most valuable way? One of my big mantras to my team this year is, well, first of all, how do we show our clients we're an essential partner every day? Because that's not something you can take for granted. But the bigger part of that is the North Star is, how do we know what is valuable to that organization or those individuals on a given day? What is valuable? And I'm not talking about value in terms of money. Like, what's actually valuable to be doing and executing? And this is making us interrogate all of that. And I'm seeing on the ground level, like many folks, our creative team is all over this because there's been a proliferation of new capabilities in some of the core enterprise tools like Adobe and Getty that are amazing. And it's helping them do stuff that was the equivalent of the PR person pasting clips into a book and measuring column inches, masking out stuff and rebuilding backgrounds in seconds. And then in our areas, which are highly, highly specialized, things like agriculture, they can have their eyes on a field and know if it's correct or not. And that's really detailed knowledge. So that's one. And then the analytics teams, how they're using it. So it's been really interesting to me to watch where have the obvious use cases taken hold? Where is that adoption? Where are people like, guys, look at this, look at this, look at this. And within the guidelines and the guardrails we've created. And then where is it that people are like, wow, I feel like it should be useful here, but I'm trying to fight for it. So that that to me is going to be something I'm watching really carefully going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And you know, you're making me think of something that my mentor and friend and occasional co-collaborator, Mark Schaefer, has been saying, pardon me, lately. We keep talking about, okay, how learning how to talk to AI, learning how to speak with AI, learning this kind of new language. And I think that's a very, very important and critical thing. But you just mentioned that, you know, it's in Adobe Suite now. And it's, you know, if you go on LinkedIn, I'm not sure if it's for all LinkedIn members, but it's, hey, you can check, you can create comments based on, you know, with a click on AI. So AI will come to you. You don't have to do anything.
That's right.
It's coming to you. So understanding like the kind of complexities of prompting may not be necessary for everyone. And I understand that. But kind of understanding the way that actually works will help you understand how to take the best advantage of what's going on inside, you know, Adobe Suite or what's going on inside Microsoft Office with Copilot. You know, these are all connected, you know. The whole thing kind of brings to mind really, and I think this is, you know, where we're going to go in a upcoming webinar that we're doing together, but let's talk about it here for a second. You know, talking with AI, and we talked about having conversations and interrogating, and I like to say interrogate because I think it's like that whole question answer thing is just kind of like such a killer interaction. But you know, communications people, and I guess marketers too, are really well suited for this. Like we have a very specific skill set in understanding the way humans relate to each other that gives us a leg up, but we're not necessarily being given that opportunity to show that we have a leg up, or we're not taking advantage of that as a profession in all the places that we can. Letting is the wrong word. Organizations, especially and enterprises, start with IT because it's a tech project. It's a tech initiative or an infrastructure initiative. You know, or they start with digital because it's on a computer, you know, it's on the web. But, you know, I would argue that it's the creative people, it's the writers and the thinkers, the folks who have to create narratives out of various kind of disparate information. The people have to interpret what others are really thinking, or what you think they're thinking, you know? These skills, creativity, curiosity, interpretation, interrogation, interviewing, all these things are the core skill set of the future for AI. And, you know, comms is, I think, uniquely qualified to do this. So what does that mean for the people that we're bringing into the profession? What does that mean for the way that teams are going to evolve if indeed, and I believe we will be, but if indeed we get the chance to show our chops here and, you know, really start to leverage AI to really contribute to our businesses and to our clients?
You know, you make me think of something I've said to my teams a number of times over the years. And I'll talk about it in the agency context, but it's absolutely true of corporate side and integrated marketing communications. And I do use that phrasing because I think it's broad. There's so much, as you said, permeability between those. Although some organizations, obviously comms and marketing are separate. I totally get that. But there's a real symbiotic. But one thing I've said to folks, especially as they're growing in their career, is to remind them, especially those that are on the comms side, because we have many different professionals here, digital, creative, paid media, project management. But overall, this industry is a really elite profession in terms of the skill sets required. If you think about all the things that we have to do and try to do well, and we're very good at beating ourselves up too, especially on the client service side. We're like, oh my God, I need to be better at this. But it's like, writing, communicating, all types of forms of writing, speed, project management, strategy, like elite communications, because most stuff goes off the rails because humans aren't communicating properly. You know, every flexibility, resilience, learning, you know, researching, sourcing, and analyzing and spitting it back out as something that is more valuable than just the component parts. So that same speech I give to people, which by the way, sometimes people have stood back and said, my God, you're right. I never conceived of myself this way. And I'm like, look, we can all grow. We all have some issues, but we need to start and understand like how elite this profession is and how much it demands. So then I very much co-sign everything you said about these skill sets. I would add research and sourcing to that. And also the ethical lens and also the questioning we do of how does that work? Why does that work? Where is that coming from? When we are in a corporation or at an agency, we spend all the time interrogating our peers or our clients. Why is that? Where's the proof? What's the backup? How does that work? Can I go to the factory? Can I see it? Can I see it? Who's the coder? So one thing that I think first and foremost that our industry needs to do is start to recognize and be mindful and engage with why it is that these skill sets are well suited for today, but that requires a mindfulness and education regarding all the things we've been talking about what AI is and is not and where it is going. I mean, we don't know where it's going eventually, but the way in which it's a more discursive, exploratory, interrogative, building, iterative process, right? So that's the first thing. We need to take more ownership of our characteristics and really be mindful and say, guys, this, and then we need to start to practice it. And we need to be thinking very strongly and clearly and mindfully and intentionally about what is, say, an entry-level role look like and what are the kinds of things where we can help folks work smarter, not harder, because the curve I want every person here to come up from intern on is I want them to come up the curve as a counselor. The counselor has to think really deeply about something. They have to self-educate. They have to learn their industry and they have to have their eyes up, eyes in the work and then eyes up to understand what's happening. So that's the dialogue I'm trying to have. It's like, how do we work smarter? So, you know, own our characteristics and own why it is, and that'll help you actually learn too how to use AI. And then figuring out, let's actually learn how to be smarter so that we can offer more value to ourselves and others faster.
All I keep thinking of is moving up the value chain, you know?
Yeah.
This whole idea of being the counselor,
the
trusted advisor, just the level of understanding and knowledge that you need to have about a business or about a client is already deeper than anybody else in the business for the most part.
Because you see across more of it too. That's one thing that's like someone in your position is having a partner. It's not just multi-stakeholder outside of your organizations. It's multi-stakeholder inside. And it's incumbent upon you to understand, I need to really understand the life of the senior counsel. I need to understand the life of our finance team. I need to understand the needs of our research and development. Like that's baked into it, I think.
It's also, you're totally right. And it's also the only, I think, it's the only role or the only function, you know, that just has to know everything, like across the entire organization, but for the purpose of connecting dots. So like, it's one thing to say, yeah, I know what's going on in that factory, or I know what's going on. It doesn't do anyone any good if you can't add to that in some way, in an additive way that nobody else is thinking over that, or that people are not necessarily in the mindset to come up with. What is the dots? What is the dot or dots that need to be connected with this particular issue? You're on a conversation, you're at a meeting. If you're an advisor and a counselor in the communication side of things, you know, you're in a leadership meeting and people are talking about A, people are talking about B. You understand A, B, C, D, E, F, G through Y and Z at a very, you know, maybe at a surface level, but you kind of get it. And you're like, wait, you skipped E. Or, you know what? I heard something about this over there that you're not taking into account. Or what happens a lot more often in corp comms is, you know, this is everything that you're talking about with brand and with product is terrific. There is our corporate mission and corporate sustainability. And so there were announcements by the CEO last week. We can plug this in here because it not only supports what you're doing, it enhances and maybe gives you some new insights and perspectives about how you might want to better market this product or, you know, what your narrative should be. And it's that additional information, the additional, I guess, packaging of different pieces of information that you have. You know, it's really important for the comms person to be the nerve center of an organization, or the comms team to be the nerve center. And, you know, back to AI, how can we, you know, work with AI to enhance that role? And part of it is, well, we can, if we're in the ground level stuff, part of it is, well, AI can now do a lot of the grunt work, right? So that we can now focus our minds higher, which is really, really important because time is your friend here. But there's also ways that we haven't discovered yet, or that we're in the process of discovering, that will enhance those connections, that will enhance what you're doing. I'm at the point now where, you know, if I have ideas about something, I may not blurt them out in a meeting, but I'll take them away and I'll create a mind map or something. And by the way, when you talk about AI coming to you, I use a tool called XMind, and XMind AI now has the capability for, as you're creating a mind map, you click on one of the branches of the mind map and you hit the little AI button. It's going to come up with 7, 8, 10 potential branches to that branch. So it's a killer brainstorming app.
Love it.
You know, that said, you know, I'll take my ideas. I'll go back to think it through. But now I have a friend. I have a little smart friend. My friend called. I have a colleague calls it your smart friend. I call it my intern. Our CEO calls it your power suit. However you want to describe it. Now you have this capability to say, you know what? I've been thinking about these things. I need you to act like a strategic advisor, and I need you to kind of walk me through a few things. This is what I heard. This is what I'm thinking. How can you help me connect these things together? Mm-hmm. Can you validate what I'm thinking? Can you come up with some other ideas? You know, and it's like having this just new employee who's super smart, but quite dumb because they're not directed. You know, so you have to direct it properly, but then you're going to get so much out of it, you know, and they lie. So it's a little intern that lies sometimes. Doesn't know it's lying, but it does.
I know we haven't talked about the beautiful euphemism of hallucinations, but just, you know, part of the wild world that we live in right now.
Well, sometimes they're straight up lies and sometimes they are hallucinations. You know, you mentioned Gemini before and I've had my issues.
Very funny.
But We'll have to save that for another time. I think we have so much here that we've spoken about, and I really appreciate the framework that you offered, really, about how we're approaching AI at these three levels, from the ground level and then the intentional engagement part of mm-hmm. the process, and moving on to this philosophical question. And I'm gonna leave it with that philosophical question almost. And with the last thing I want to ask you before we wrap up, which is maybe not related to AI, but maybe it could be, but it's just the question I ask a lot of my guests, which is, what's keeping you up at night these days, Anne? And, if it's related to everything we've talked about, that's cool too. But, what's keeping you up? What's the last things that your last words that you would say to our listeners today?
Oh my gosh, I don't want to become very dystopic at the end of our wonderful conversation. I am kept up with a connection with what we've been talking about, with just the proliferation of divisiveness and fake stuff online and very much engineered. I really put it in the category of disinformation, or also the convenience to many actors around the world, both either for money or for nation state meddling, to rile people up and create rancor and anger. Mm-hmm. And that is upsetting to me. I'm thinking a lot about the fact that there is many issues that it could become politicized that I think are actually really just important for us as a human society, like inclusion, and understanding the difference is a strength. And that's true of the states and the political landscape with the election year. So that stuff keeps me up. But I think also just the state of the world. I was a Star Trek fan for years. Mm-hmm. In Star Trek, there was sort of a feeling underneath of utopianism, and that as much as humans would screw things up, that we, the plucky humans, would pull it out at the end. That was really Captain Kirk's whole personality. While Spock was like, I wouldn't advise that. And Captain Kirk's like, let's go for it. We're the plucky humans. So I'm really hopeful, while I'm also worried about where we're at right now, because we're at a lot of crossroads as usual. So running a business, I'd love to see resilience. I love to see the economy doing well and dealing with a lot of weird curveballs. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful for the resilience of our people. So I have a lot of confidence, but I'm definitely watching the big picture landscape. And the AI is a big part of that, because when you're asked to shepherd an organization, whether you're internal or running it as I am, that's a lot of responsibility. And I feel the need to keep my eye on the big picture here.
Yeah. And thank goodness you are. I mean, we need more people like you who are looking at the big picture. I would like to be a little hopeful with my thinking about AI. And my hope is that humans, by nature, are inventive and creative. And, again, back to where we started, this is not a zero-sum game. Things are going to change and continue to change. And they have the potential to really change in a terrific way. On that note, Anne, I think our listeners, if they want to reach out to you, they can just go to gscommunications.com. They can look up Anne Green on LinkedIn. That's Anne with an E and Green with no E.
That's
often
correct.
Get them confused, but Anne Green. Any place else that people should be looking for you, Anne?
Really, LinkedIn, yeah. Anne Green and GS Communications. That's our website. And, I'm always happy to connect. These are big picture issues. I love being in touch with folks like you, Dan, and others talking about these. So I do welcome people to reach out and connect.
Thanks so much. And I know we're going to be in touch a lot more in the near future. So again, thanks for coming on The Trending Communicator, Anne. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time to listen in on today's conversation. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe through the podcast player of your choice, share with your friends and colleagues, and leave me a review. 5 stars would be preferred, but it's up to you. Do you have ideas for future guests or you want to be on the show? Let me know at dan@trendingcommunicator.com. Thanks again for listening to The Trending Communicator.